Welcome back to Tales of Southwest Michigan's Past. This is Michael Delaware. I am your host. Now, as many of you know out there, I release my new book, Victorian Southwest Michigan True Crime, in March, and it includes several stories essentially from the 1800s in the Southwest Michigan region. In fact, there's 17 in all in the book. Now, as anyone who works on historical research and writing will tell you, that there's a lot of hours that you go into any project, and whether it's a single story or the whole book, but they will also tell you that it is not possible to do it without the help of others along the way. And in the journey of finding the details of any story, you're going to meet and encounter a lot of interesting people. And in writing my book, I interacted with many historical societies and librarians. And I also received a lot of encouragement from friends and colleagues along the way as I put this book together. One such person who would definitely be on the list of somebody who helped encourage me to continue and finish this project was my friend Bobby Mathis, who is the president of the Union City Society for Historic Preservation. We met about 3 years ago on this podcast, and we've just become good friends over the years working with events back and forth together. We share a common nerdy fascination with old stories from the past, and over the years that I've gotten to know her, we have shared ideas and stories, and whenever she comes across stuff in my area or thinks something that she thinks I might be interested in, she shares it with me, and I try to do the same with her. In fact, Bobby was instrumental in putting me on the trail to one of the larger stories in my book, and it was called The Crouch Murders. And so there's a portion of that story that actually happened in Union City, and she shared it with me, and that's how I found the rest of the story. So when my editors were working with me on the final draft of the manuscript, they asked me to put an acknowledgement page together. And of course, there were many names that I felt I wanted to acknowledge that helped me with the project. But among them was Bobby Mathis, because without a doubt, she actually helped me on the path through almost one full story in the book. So she was quite amazing with that. So when the book was released, I made sure I took one of my author copies that they gave me, which were only a few, and I gave one to her. Now, a funny thing happened. In reading the book, she reached out to me, and she looked at another story that was in the collection that happened in Coldwater, and she discovered that she had a personal connection with that long-forgotten murder tale. And she shared with me a whole bunch of interesting material she's found about it. So I thought it would be absolutely fun to have her back on the program today to talk about some true crime stories, as well as this story and other things that are happening in Union City as the weather gets warmer. So it's my pleasure to have her back on the program today. Welcome, Bobby. Thank you for taking time to join me again.
Well, thank you for having me back. I always enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. We've done a lot of fun projects over the last 3 years together.
Yes.
So
we sure have.
You've been with the Union City Society for Historic Preservation, I guess, over a decade now. Could you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and the organization itself for those that maybe never heard the earlier episodes?
Sure. I started with the Union City Society for Historic Preservation in 2017. And I started mainly working with restoration of headstones here at Riverside Cemetery, which brought me into contact with a lot of research on the individuals buried here. And it got me really interested in joining the Historical Society. I thought, oh, I want to be part of, you know, telling the story of Union City's past and bringing to light some of these stories that have been forgotten for so long in Union City. We had, you know, the Historical Society's been around in Union City since 1987, but I don't think a lot had been done with digging up really, really deep stories that had been forgotten. And we worked on a tale here that's quite infamous here in Union City, which is the Legend of Dead Man's Hollow.
Correct, yeah.
And we've told that for about 3 years in a row. And that story had been lost to time, and kind of fun to bring that back to the public's attention back in 1914 when, you know, we dug up the true story about what really happened here. And then since then, we've dug up other stories you know, about more recent things. And we do cemetery tours every year here, telling stories about five or six individuals. And everybody seems to love those. They're very popular. And so I just love history, and I enjoy bringing that to light and getting the community involved with that. Several of our people here in town do act in our cemetery tour portrayals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's fun to kind of like educate. I'm an educator. I'm an art teacher as well. So teaching these cemetery classes about restoring these headstones and how to fix them and bring the history, I feel like a teacher all the way around. And so I think I've brought, you know, my talents to at least bringing some attention to those.
You are originally from Union City, right?
Yes, I was born and raised here. I went to Union City High School, mm-hmm. and attended Western Michigan University in our education. So, but the Historical Society, I've just always been here. I haven't strayed too far away from my roots.
Well, it's hard to not start working at a cemetery and then not become interested in the stories that lay beneath the stones. And that's kind of how it started with me. I was interested in history, but what really took off for me with my YouTube channel and things is when I started looking around at all the headstones that were out there. Like, there's stories and stories and stories waiting to be told out there that, you know, are lost and forgotten.
Yeah. Every time I think I've found, like, all the stories, there's, like, they keep popping up. You know, I'm working on a book right now about all the people that are buried in Riverside. There's 7,000 people buried here.
More That's people a lot of dead. Stories for one book.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have like, 3 or 4 volumes of this book.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, yep. But I love it. I can't find any weirder stories, and I keep finding cool ones all the time.
Yeah, that's great. So in reading my book, you got to the story that I wrote, titled In Cold Blood, The Murder of James Robinson, which happened in 1894 in Coldwater. And in reading it, you had a realization. You want to tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize it when I started reading it. It sounded very familiar. Uh-huh. And so I got to the main character and I said, wait a minute, I recognize this name, mm-hmm. of Alton Meisner,
right?
Which you're going to tell a little bit about that in a little bit. But I realized he married a relative of mine. Mm-hmm. So that really intrigued me. And then I dug in a little deeper and I said, hey, wait a minute, I've got some stuff
that you came across
here.
Yeah, that was a challenging story to put together because I had not found any Coldwater newspapers. I'm sure they had a lot of stuff, and I think that's where you found the information that you sent me, mm-hmm. Which didn't really stray too far from what I had written, but it gave a lot more details that I was able to find, and I found that kind of interesting. We'll try to go into some of that today.
And plus, I could give you the background on the family history.
Right.
Because of, you know, he was married quite a few times, and so I can give you a background history on one of the wives because he married my first cousin.
Wow. So I suppose I should probably tell the audience a little bit about the story before we expound upon some of the details. So the story's called In Cold Blood, and it is the murder of James Robinson. It happened in 1894. And I'm just going to kind of give you a synopsis of the story. Alton Meisner married a young girl by the name of Daisy Bell Smith in Coldwater in February of 1894. And she had just recently turned 17. So I guess they'd been dating when she was 16 years old. But there's some references in the stories that say she was 16.
Yes.
So it's little unclear, but anyways, I picked up the story from the night before the murder happened. She went to go stay at her father's farm because he was apparently going out of town for the day. And when she returned home the next morning, just kind of on intuition, and she started knocking on the door because she was surprised to find the front door locked when she came home. And Alton was not coming to the door, and she kept insisting. And he kept saying, go away, come back later. And she said, wait a minute, this is my house, you know. So she's knocking on the door. She finally got him to open the door. And she goes in and she walks around the house. And in one of the bedrooms, or the bedroom that they had, there's a dead body laying on the floor. Mm-hmm. And it was the body of an older man who was lying on the floor. And he'd had several wounds on his head. And Alton said, oh, just ignore that. He was a drifter. Yeah. Nothing to see here, you know. He was a drifter that tried to attack me when I opened the front door this morning, so I killed him in self-defense, and I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. And she said, well, you need to go call the constable or tell the authorities. And he said, no, I'll take care of it. And he takes the body and hides it in the basement. And I think this was Saturday, so overnight they had this body down in their basement. And the next morning, he gets up and he takes the body out of the house, and she doesn't know what he does with it, but he takes it out. And then the next few days, the neighbors start noticing that a neighborhood farmer that was kind of an old man who worked a farm by himself was missing. No one had seen him, and it was unusual for them to drive by and not see him working in his field. So they thought, well, maybe he's had a health condition, and they went to go looking for him. And that was James Robinson. And no one could find him. And they started getting really concerned. They notified the police. The police came out. They formed kind of a neighborhood search party. You know, the police didn't really have any reason to get involved too much at that point. But the neighbors said, well, we're going to start searching the neighborhood fields because maybe he passed out somewhere. And then one of the guys comes up to them, and it's Mr. Alton Meisner, and he walks up to them and he says, oh, he sold me the farm. Here's the deed and here's the paperwork. And he said he was heading up north to his family. And they're all looking at this document saying, that does not sound like the characteristic of Mr. Robinson. We all knew him. We've known him for years. He would say goodbye if he did something like that. And they thought this guy was a bit of shifty looking, suspicious. So they went down and called the police and said, you know, you need to come out here. And in the process, they started searching thoroughly the barn and area looking for James Robinson. And at some point, they knew that there was a missing man and that there was a search. And Daisy finds out about it when she's in town. And she goes in and tells her what she saw and the dead body and the whole story and confesses. And in finding out that Alton is somehow involved in this thing and this missing man, she attempts to kill herself. Some people catch her in the process of doing it, and she survives. But they find James Robinson's body buried in a shallow grave under a manure pile next to the barn. And so it's kind of a sad way to be disposing of a body. Very good way to go. So they, of course, they take Wisner and they put him on trial, and he gets on trial and he starts pretending to be crazy and all of this stuff. And ironically, the ironic thing about it is the trial began on the following 1895 in February. It was the anniversary of their marriage, which was really weird. So they had just been married a year before, and on happy anniversary, I'm going to jail.
Here you go.
So that was kind of an interesting story. And of course, he gets convicted and sent to prison. And he was eventually transferred to the insane asylum in Kalamazoo. But within a few years, he was sent back to Jackson. And he was given a conditional pardon in 1911.
He was denied pardon in 1904 first.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then he finally did. Yeah, out of a life sentence, he served 16 years of it.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that where they would petition the governors a lot. And it depends on the mood of the governor that was in the office at the time, whether they would do it. But apparently Governor Chase Osborne is the one that pardoned him in 1911. And then I found a record of 1918 that Daisy, who is now his ex-wife, took him to court for alimony in 1918. So That was the extent of the story I found, but you found some other interesting stuff about it.
Yeah, well, I'll start from where I guess he comes into my family, right?
Right. We'll so Daisy was like his second wife, right?
Yeah, out of four.
Out of four. Wow. So he married twice more after he was a murderer.
Yes.
After he was a convicted murderer, after he got out of prison. Wow.
I don't know what he had. He had something, I guess.
Well, we just didn't have... Nobody could Google back then.
Yeah. red flags. So how he comes into my family is he married my first cousin, Elizabeth Maynard. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth Maynard was from Colon. And, of course, Alton was born in Bethel. So it's not that far. It's Bethel, Michigan. And they met and they married in 1880. I've got some differing dates, 82, 83 in Colon, Michigan. Uh-huh. And they had two children together. They had Cyrus Meisner, who lived until 1944. So he did live quite some time.
Okay.
And then they had a child of William Meisner. And the odd thing about that is that William Meisner only lived for 10 years. He was born in 1884, so they had him right after marriage. And he lived, and he died in 1894, the same year he married Daisy.
Wow.
So the night of the murder, he said, "I've got to go to my son's funeral." From my first wife.
Oh, okay. So that was where he was going. Okay.
Yes. And so he comes like, "Oh, poor me. I have my son's funeral to go to. My wife has tried to commit suicide and now I've got murder. It's pretty hard life on me, isn't it?"
Yeah.
That's what he said. Pretty hard on me, ain't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh, like we should feel sorry for him. Woe is me. So
yeah, exactly.
I don't know what happened. I think probably some degree of it, Elizabeth goes and she testifies because she's pulled to trial, too, to testify on his mental capacity, you know, of course, during all this. And she admits that Alton was prone to epilepsy. So he had had fits and seizures. And she said it was from a limb falling on his head at one time and that he started having. But then he comes and he retorts this and said, "No, wait a minute. This runs in my family. Epilepsy runs in my family. Insanity runs in my family." And I think he's trying to, you know, prove his, you know, plea of being insane.
Right,
all this stuff. And he acts weird on trial. You know, if you're looking at some of the trial transcripts, he's behaving oddly and weird. He's doing weird things. He's having seizures and stuff. And so I think maybe some of that had, you know, to do with maybe the separation. She couldn't, you know, take it being married, you know, his odd behaviors and everything, which would maybe explain why they weren't together that long, because she went ahead and she obviously remarried two more times to Edgar Ormsby. And then another gentleman she married, Rigby, and she's buried here in Riverside. She's Eleanor Rigby. So
Eleanor Rigby, little Beatles song.
No, wait a minute. It's not Eleanor, but that is Elizabeth Rigby, which brought the Beatles song in my head. I'm like, Eleanor Rigby, you know.
Right.
She's buried there as Elizabeth Rigby. So during that time, you know, they must have separated. That must have been hard on their marriage. And so immediately he marries this, he's seeing this, maybe this is why the marriage ended. Uh-huh. He meets this 16-year-old Daisy Bell, right?
Right.
Daisy Bell Smith, who, you know, is green. She's a greenhorn. She doesn't know any better. And so she gets involved with Mr. Alton Meisner. And they're not married, I think, very long. And then he ends up, you know, during the murder trial, he goes to prison and so it's around 1895 he's sentenced to prison. And then I found a census in 1910 of him being at the Jackson prison, being a twine maker. So that's his job in prison, is to make twine or do that, give him menial tasks, you know. And so he eventually, before this, he has a reputation of, I've tried to look at the census just to see what he did, you know, in later years, like in the 1920 census, 1910, you know. So when he got out, he was known as during his marriage, his third marriage. Okay, so here's marriage number three. Uh-huh. Clara Burson. He marries her in 1916. So not much longer after he gets, you know, out of prison. And he's a he's an inspector. He's known as an inspector. So he divorced her. They were only married 3 years. So that marriage didn't last very long either. And then he gets married again in 1922 to a Laura Shaw. And these are both in Detroit. So he's now in Detroit.
That would make sense. That's how you can bury your past, is just go start in another town back in that time.
Someplace else,
yeah.
So he's known, get this, in 1922, on his marriage certificate to Laura Shaw, he's known as a horse educator. So he was a horse trainer in Ovid, Michigan. He was very known, well known in the area for being a horse trainer, like a horse whisperer, I guess. Uh-huh. And he did very well with horses. And that's probably how he got to know James Robinson, you know, talking him back and forth, and
probably
had eyes on that, you know, farm, and thought, I can get this farm and do my horse training here and live with my life with Daisy Bell, and nobody will know, none the wiser, if I knock this old man off and take this farm.
And forge some documents and just...
Forge some documents. And here's an interesting thing. He claimed to be a mind reader. He said he could read people's minds. So he was an interesting character. And there's pictures of him that I ran across, and I sent you one. One of him, in the story in the Coldwater paper, the Coldwater Courier, there's pictures of him. And then of the barn, you know, these are all hand-drawn illustrations, because obviously there's no photography to be, well, there is, but not for this time, for this story. And then, you know, even diagrams of where Mr. Robinson had been attacked, you know, the wounds and everything. Wow. And reading up on that Mr. Robinson lived for like a half an hour. You know, he didn't
after
die.
After they found him? Wow,
no,
so he was...
After he'd been murdered, he lived like a half an hour. And
so
then
he was probably alive when Daisy saw him, possibly.
Yeah.
Depends on when he attacked. Interesting. I know he hit him with a blacksmith's
hatchet.
Hammer.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a hatchet?
They said, in the paper, it says a hatchet or an axe, because they said there was like triangular divots like near his cheekbone. He had been attacked like... hit like, I don't know, so many times, not as many as Lizzie Borden's, but
there was an article that I found that said they found the actual murder weapon, and it was a blacksmith's hammer.
Okay,
which would be very similar and misidentified to an axe or something like that.
I think at that time, you know, everybody just kind of went with whatever, and you know, with the Crouch murders, everybody's stomping around. The other story we're talking about, you know, in your book.
Yeah.
You know, who knows how secure the crime scene is, but yeah, pretty sure that he hadn't been dead that long after they found him under the manure pile.
Uh-huh.
And he was still just freshly, you know, his body had, you know, obviously started to have not limber. What do you call that? When you have a, you stiffen up.
Rigor mortis hadn't set in yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So pretty fresh. So I'm trying to think of other things that he had. So that's what Elizabeth testified on trial. And on trial, the trial became so sensational, it garnered a lot of attention. Everybody started coming to it. It was quite entertaining to watch, I guess, Mr. Meisner try to prove how insane he was.
Yeah, and does it surprise you that there was in the article it mentions that they stemmed off the potential for a lynch mob, that they thought a lynch mob was forming. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because that was a pretty common thing in that period of time. Because it happened in the Charlotte story, where they found the guy who murdered a young man or a young girl that's in the book. And there was a lynch mob forming outside. So if they'd released him, they would have lynched him. And so he confessed and went to prison, because he's like, I know that there's no point in me going to trial, because I'll get killed if I stay here. And they all knew he did it. And he, you know, it was pretty obvious he did it. And that's one of the stories of Nellie Griffin in the book. So that's, that was kind of a thing that happened in the, right around that time, the 1880s to the 1900s. Well, there was a lot of that lynch mobbing.
They said there would have been, but I guess in this case, nobody got enough gumption up to head it.
Right, yeah.
Like, they couldn't find an organizer and like, never mind.
Yeah. It's like, we'll just let the police handle it. Yeah. Yeah. But there was some funny stuff about the trial that you came up that you found.
So apparently he would act really oddly, and this attention brought a lot of like almost like a movie. So uh-huh. people were like, "Ooh, let's go watch this weirdo," you know, yeah. in his trial, because he would act abnormal. Like, I don't know whether he was seizuring at the time, and that was part of like maybe they were watching him have seizures and epilepsy uh-huh. at the time. But he would do gross, obscene things, you know, with uh-huh. you know, just to appear even more grotesque and more insane than he was. And people would begin bringing their dinner to the trial and eat it at the trial. Dinner and a show.
Wow. Yeah, I know that it was funny because the news articles of that were insinuating that he was putting it on and it was fake. And mm-hmm. and that was, I mean, getting an insanity plea was, that was how they did it. These pretended to be insane at trial. So there's several cases with that. Mm-hmm. Sarah Haviland attempted to do that in the courtroom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's a couple of other times I've heard about that happening in during that time period. So
it makes me wonder how much of it was a show and how much of it maybe was that he was uh-huh. having some kind of epileptic seizure or fit. If he, you know, he's saying, you know, runs in his family. I don't know if, you know, that's hereditary, but it's definitely something to think about if he's claiming that he has a family history of insanity.
Yeah, it could very well be he did, you know.
But again, he is trying to get off. So that's you're going to put on a show. But yeah, they were entertained. No popcorn back then, but they brought dinner anyway.
Even at the Crouch trial over in Jackson, there was a lot of people showing up for that. And some of the other trials that I covered in the book, it was the talk of the town. You go to the courtroom and watch the trial, you know.
Mm-hmm. That was the entertainment, you know. Yeah. And the papers were so salacious back then. You could read, you know, the uh-huh. details you can't get today.
Right.
You know, you're not going to go into that amount of detail in a murder today.
No, not at all. I had yeah. another newspaper man tell me that they could tell stories that we'd get fined and all kinds of stuff for saying that in the newspaper today. You know.
Yeah. So
it's kind exactly. of.
But so Elizabeth wasn't going to defend him at all. Uh-huh. And so she let up. She said, yeah, go ahead, put him in prison. Uh-huh. And that was the end of Elizabeth and Alton. But yeah, I was surprised that he went ahead and got married two more times after that. He must have uh-huh. gotten something together. And by the way, he died in Kentucky.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah, he died in 1922 and he died of heart disease. He was 59.
Mm. Wow.
So
crazy life.
I know.
I wasn't able to find much on James Robinson other than he was an old farmer. He was in his, mm-hmm. you know, sad case, you know.
I don't know what he did. If he had any children or not, or.
Well, I mean, other than the lie that Meisner, you know, said about him, that he'd said he had a son up north, but that could have just been invented, you know. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Robinson is such a common name, it was very hard to find much on him at all, other than he was a farmer. So.
Because he must have been in that Coldwater area, so he must have traveled around. He got, I think, being a horse educator, he must have gotten around educating horses. So,
yeah, very interesting. So, do you have some events coming up in Union City on the calendar already with. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff we're going to talk about, what's going on down there in Union City. What plans do we have coming up now that the weather is starting to warm up?
We're having you come and talk.
Right.
Yes. So we're excited for that. May 18th, you're going to come to our event center, All Things Serenity Event Center. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a co-author there. Marty Chard is going to be there. Also promoting his new book, which is the history of rural schoolhouses in the area, like one room schoolhouses. So if you want to learn a little bit about the history of like the old rural schools that used to be here in Branch County, he talks at great length. He details, you know, the Holly School, the Lincoln School, the Day School. Some of older listeners may recognize some of these older schools that, you know, their parents or their grandparents went to. So we're excited for that because Marty's done quite a few cool books for us, and hopefully you'll be talking about the Crouch murders.
We will. I have put a special presentation just for you guys on that one, so it'll be
nice.
Fun. And, yeah, it's kind of, that's a wild and crazy story. It's one I've covered on this podcast before, but it takes place in Jackson, but it has an overlap into Union City and back and forth. It's a very crazy, wild story, and it's very sad that no one ever went to jail for the crime.
Yeah, so many.
No one was ever prosecuted.
I can't wait to see who your hypothesis is, who you think did it. We'll have to hear.
I don't know. It's a head scratcher. I think Foy was definitely involved. That was the guy.
He knew a lot, yeah.
Yeah, he certainly knew too much. So my suspicion is they had the right people. They just didn't have the evidence to put them away.
Well, that, and like they said, securing the crime scene back then was just not on the top of the list.
Which is really an interesting topic in itself. I mean, because the crime scene at the Crouch murders was trampled and people had been all over it before the police got there. And that happened obviously a lot. But that, do you know when that officially actually became like we see modern in these crime shows?
No.
Yeah, and it's kind of significant that it is. We're talking about it because it was the O.J. Simpson trial.
Really?
That late in history, like the 1980s, when crime scene protocol that they do today that we see in all these crime shows was really hammered in because the O.J. Simpson crime scene was so compromised.
Wow.
Which really brings into question, you know, if they had the evidence correct. I mean, there were so many people that if you watch the documentary that was done on that, that's when I learned about that. There was a documentary that said there were so many people tromping through that crime scene before the chief investigators got there that they missed all kinds of evidence. There was
and they just zeroed in on O.J. You know, at the Crouch when people were taking actual souvenirs from the home.
Right.
Which could have been evidence.
Yeah, people were walking up and, oh, here's the bullet I found, you know, handing it to the police guys. Like, well, it's like, and so the same thing I think was going on at the O.J. trial, at least according to that documentary. And of course, there's a lot of people that believe that he did it, and he may very well have. I think he knew who did it if he didn't do it, you know. And I think the only reason he wasn't saying it was probably somebody else in his family, like his son, is what that documentary kind of supposed. And that would be why he would keep silent on who, because he got himself off and he's not going to put the finger on his son. So that would also make him go crazy, too. So that's my theory, is if he didn't do it himself.
Right.
It was probably his son he was protecting that did it, you know, because they both had history of problems with Nicole Brown Simpson, I guess her name was, or something.
Yes.
Like that.
So
very interesting. But that was an interesting thing to come across. The crime scenes after that, they started really putting in the protocols about it gets taped and locked down. And
well, forensics is such an advanced, field of study now. There's so many new ways to solve crimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have one other event coming up.
Okay.
And that's June 15th. If people are interested, there's a cemetery workshop I always do.
Oh, I was wondering when you were going to put that on the calendar. That's awesome. That is a well-attended event, and a lot of people really get a lot out of that.
Yeah, and Andrew, my friend Andrew Nolan from Silent Cities is coming back to help me with that. Mm-hmm. Just walking through the cemetery this spring, I always take an assessment. So I walk through to see, what needs to be fixed, what needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And there's always a couple new stones that either have tilted or fallen or broken due to not vandalism or anything. It's just natural, you know, weather conditions and the way the, you know, they the ground upheaval and everything. So I've got a few new ones to fix and some cool fixes, and we show people how to clean headstones correctly, how to repair headstones. And if you want to get into that and you want to learn how to even begin, like for your own community, to save headstones and restore them in a correct do-no-harm method, we offer training that you can take back to your own community and start working on, you know, some of these headstones to preserve history, because sometimes the headstone is the only thing left of an individual that tells that that person was ever here and their story. So it's it starts at 9. It's like 9 to whatever time we break, you know, 9 to 3. Usually we go 9 to 3. And we go through all sorts of demonstrations and fixes. And my friend, Andrea Chamberlain, she's coming to help out as well.
Awesome. And is there a fee for that? What's the...
Yes, if you go to Eventbrite, I'll send you a link to that.
Okay.
People can sign up. It's, I think it's $35 or $40 to come and fix. But it's so worth the amount of knowledge that you're taking away from it, that, you know, you can, and you can go and show other people how to do it. So
very worthwhile attending. I've heard a lot of people really raving about the what they've learned just by attending that workshop. And of course you did one of the similar presentation to that last year at the museum, and people were just in awe about.
Oh yeah. My symbology tour. Yes.
Yeah. That was a very, very good, amazing presentation that you put together.
Thank you.
So definitely give me the link, and I'll put the link to that in the show note description, and I'll put the link to the event that I'm doing down in Union City there.
Yes, and, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Get more folks down there. So any last minute things you'd like to share today, Bobby, about Union City or its happenings? You get excited about the summer? It's finally feeling like we can, you know, get out there without a coat on?
Yeah, I was out. In fact, I was out today just repairing a headstone, just fixed one. So it's getting warm enough. They haven't turned the water on the cemetery yet, but I brought my own water with me, and we're past freezing point. So that means I can get out and start working. And I've been working on my book and finding more really crazy stories to share with you and my historical society. And hopefully I will just find more crazy stories and you'll be able to make another book.
Yeah, well, we'll have to have you back on the show really soon to hear some of these crazy stories. We have crazy stories with Bobby Mathis.
Yeah.
Like an episode on crazy stories.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Bobby. I have been speaking with Bobby Mathis from the Union City Society for Historic Preservation. And as always, she is a wealth of information about lots of interesting bits of history, especially in the Union City area. And she is a tremendous organizer of great events down there to support the history and preservation in that area. So definitely check out the links in the show note description that that she has going on. And if you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me at michaeldelaware.com. I also have a full calendar of the events that I have on that website, which you can find quite easily. And come see me at one of my upcoming book signings and talk about the stories that are in my book. I'm always seem to be telling one of the stories out of the 17 at some book talk. So there's a lot of events like that out there.
I loved your book. It was great. Loved it.
Thank you.
Read it.
All right. Well, until next time, folks, when we take another journey into yesterday and we explore even more fascinating tales of Southwest Michigan's past. Thank you for listening.